to achieve the short-term goal of gaining cooperation from his son. Benefit number two. Connection builds the brain. As we explained in the previous chapter, no drama discipline builds the brain of a child by improving his capacity for relationships, self-control, empathy, personal insight, and much more. We discussed the importance of setting limits, creating structure, and helping children build internal controls and impulse inhibition by internalizing no. This is how we use our relationship with our children to build their brains' executive functions. We also discussed other ways to develop a child's relational and decision-making abilities. Each interaction with our kids offers the opportunity to build their brains and further their capacity to be the kind of people we hope they'll be. And it all begins with connection. In addition to the short-term benefit of moving them from reactivity to receptivity, connecting during a disciplinary interaction also impacts children's brains in ways that will have long-term effects as they grow up. When we offer comfort when our kids are upset, when we listen to their feelings, when we communicate how much we love them, even when they've messed up, when we respond in these ways, we significantly impact the way their brains develop and the kind of people they'll be, both now and as they move into adolescence and adulthood. In upcoming chapters, we'll talk more about redirection, including the explicit lessons we teach and the behaviors we model as we interact with our children. Obviously, a child's brain will be greatly impacted by what we communicate to him when we respond to misbehavior. And it will also be changed by what we model with our own actions in the moment. Whether consciously or subconsciously, a child's brain will assimilate all kinds of information based on the parental response to any situation. The more pertinent point here is about connection and how parents change and even build children's brains based on what children experience in that disciplinary moment. To put it in more neurological terms, connection strengthens the connective fibers between the upstairs and downstairs brain so that the higher parts of the brain can more effectively communicate with and override the lower, more primitive impulses. We nickname these fibers connecting upper and lower brain areas the staircase of the brain. The staircase integrates upstairs and downstairs and benefits the region of the brain called the prefrontal cortex. This key area of the brain helps create the executive functions of self-regulation, including balancing our emotions, focusing our attention, controlling our impulses, and connecting us empathically with others. As the prefrontal cortex develops, children will be better able to put into practice the social and emotional skills we want them to develop and ultimately to master as they move through our home and out into the larger world. To put it simply, integration in a relationship creates integration in the brain. An integrated relationship develops when we honor differences between ourselves and others and then connect through compassionate communication. We empathize with another person, feeling their feelings and understanding their point of view. In this connection, we respect another person's inner mental life, but do not become the other person. This is how we remain differentiated individuals, but also connect. Such integration creates harmony in a relationship. Amazingly, interpersonal integration can also be seen at the heart of how parent-child relationships cultivate integration in the child's brain. This is how differentiated regions, like left and right or up and down, remain unique and specialized, but also become linked. Regulation in the brain depends upon the coordination and balance of various regions that emerge from integration. And such neural integration is the basis for executive functions, the capacity to regulate attention, emotions, thoughts, and behavior. That's the secret of the sauce. Interpersonal integration cultivates internal neural integration. So that's the long-term benefit of connection. Through relationships, it creates neural linkages and grows integrative fibers that literally change the brain and leave our kids more skilled at making good decisions, participating in relationships, and interacting successfully with their world. Benefit number 3. Connection deepens the relationship with your child. So connection offers the short-term benefit of moving kids from reactivity to receptivity and the long-term benefit of building the brain. The third benefit we want to highlight is a relational one. Connection deepens the bond between you and your child. Moments of conflict can be the most difficult and precarious times in any relationship. They can also be among the most important. Of course, our kids know we're there for them when we're snuggling and reading a book together, or when we show up and cheer at their performances. But what about when tension and conflict arise? When we have incompatible desires or opinions? These moments are the real test. How we respond to our children when we're not happy with their choices, with loving guidance, with irritation and criticism, with fury and a shaming outburst, will impact the development of our relationship with them and even their own sense of self. It's not always easy to even want to connect when our kids misbehave or when they're acting their ugliest and most out of control. Connecting might be the last thing in the world you want to do when a fight breaks out between your kids on a quiet airplane, or when they whine and complain about not getting a better treat after you've just taken them to the movies. But connection should be our first response in virtually any disciplinary situation, not only because it can help us deal with the problem in the short term, not only because it will make our children better people in the long term, but also, and most important, because it helps us communicate how much we value the relationship. We know that our children have changeable, and complex brains, and that they need us when they're struggling. The more we respond with empathy, support, and listening, the better it will be for our relationship with them. Tina recently attended a birthday party with her 6-year-old at his friend Sabrina's house. Her parents, Basil and Kimberly, walked the guests out at the end of the party. When they returned to the living room of the house, they were met with a surprise. Here's how Kimberly put it in an email to Tina. After the party, Sabrina went into the house and opened all of her gifts unsupervised, so I couldn't write down who gave her what. It was pandemonium. I managed to piece together most of the items because my daughter, Sierra, had been there when she opened them. Before Sabrina writes out the thank you cards, I'd like to get this clarified. Did JP get her the kaleidoscope chalk? I'm sure Miss Manners would disapprove of my tactics, but I'd rather get it right than be nonspecific. In this situation, we could certainly empathize with a tired parent for not handling herself well when she returned to the living room to find recently opened toys everywhere and torn wrapping paper littering the entire floor. After all, Kimberly had just hosted a fun but loud, entertaining but chaotic birthday party for 15 6-year-olds and their parents and siblings. The circumstances were ripe for a parental meltdown, highlighted by lots of yelling about a spoiled kid who couldn't even wait until the party was over before ripping into the presents like a wild animal tearing into meat. By maintaining her own self-control, though, Kimberly was able to address the situation from a no-drama, whole-brain frame of mind, which led her to begin with, you guessed it, connection. Rather than launching into a lecture or a tirade, she connected with her daughter. She first acknowledged how fun it was to have had the party and now to get to open all of the presents. She even sat patiently as Sabrina showed her the set of fake mustaches she was so excited about. You have to know Sabrina. And then, once Kimberly had connected, she spoke with her daughter, teaching her what she wanted her to know about presents and waiting and thank you notes. That's how connection created an integrative opportunity, building a stronger brain and strengthening a relationship. Will you be able to connect first every time your kids mess up or lose control of themselves? Of course not. We certainly don't with our own kids, but the more frequently we can make connection our first response, regardless of what our children have done, or whether or not we ourselves are in the river of well-being, the more we'll show our kids that they can count on us to offer solace, unconditional love, and support, even when they've acted in ways we don't like. Talk about fortifying and deepening a relationship. What's more, in strengthening your own relationship with your children, you'll be better equipping them to be good siblings, friends, and partners as they move toward adulthood. You'll be teaching by role modeling, guiding by what you do and not only by what you say. That's the relational benefit of connection. It teaches kids what it means to be in a relationship and to love, even when we're not happy with the choices made by the person we love. What about tantrums? Aren't we supposed to ignore them? When we teach parents about connecting and redirecting, one of the most common questions we hear is about tantrums. Usually, someone in the audience will ask something like, "I thought we were supposed to ignore tantrums. Doesn't connecting with a kid when he's freaking out just give him attention? So doesn't that just reinforce the negative behavior?" Our response to this question reveals another place where the no-drama, whole-brain philosophy deviates from conventional approaches. Yes, there may be times when a child throws what we might call a strategic tantrum, when he's in control of himself and is willfully acting distressed to achieve a desired end, to get a toy he wants, to stay at the park longer, and so on. But with most children, and almost always with young children, strategic tantrums are much, much more the exception than the rule. The vast majority of the time, a tantrum is evidence that a child's downstairs brain has hijacked his upstairs brain and left him legitimately and honestly out of control. Or, even if the child isn't fully dysregulated, he's enough out of sorts in his nervous system that he whines or doesn't have the capacity to be flexible and manage his feelings in that moment. And if a child is unable to regulate his emotions and actions, our response should be to offer help and emphasize comfort. We should be nurturing and empathic and focus on connection. Whether he's out of sorts and just beginning to move down the road to distress, or so upset that he's actually out of control, he needs us in this moment. We still need to set limits. We can't let a child in his distress yank down the curtains at the restaurant, but our objective in that moment is to comfort him and help him calm down so he can regain control of himself. Recall that chaos and losing control are signs of blocked integration, where the different parts of the brain are not working as a coordinated whole. And since connection creates integrative opportunities, connection becomes the way we comfort. Integration creates the ability to regulate emotions, and that's how we soothe our kids, helping them move from the chaos or rigidity of non-integrated states to the calmer and clearer harmony of integration and well-being. So, when parents ask for our opinion on tantrums, our response is that we need to completely reframe the way we think about the times our kids are the most upset and out of control. We suggest that parents view a tantrum not merely as an unpleasant experience they have to learn to get through, manage for their own benefit, or stop as soon as possible at all costs, but instead as a plea for help, as another opportunity to make a child feel safe and loved. It's a chance to soothe distress to be a haven when an internal storm is raging, to practice moving from a state of disintegration into a state of integration through connection. That's why we call these moments of connection integrative opportunities. Remember that a child's repeated experience of having her caregiver be emotionally responsive and attuned to her, connect with her, builds her brain's ability to self-regulate and self-soothe over time, leading to more independence and resilience. So, a no-drama response to a tantrum begins with parental empathy. When we understand why children have tantrums, that their young, developing brains are subject to becoming disintegrated as their big emotions take over, then we're going to offer a much more compassionate response when the screaming, yelling, and kicking begin. It doesn't mean we'll ever enjoy a child's tantrum. If you do, you might consider seeking professional help. But viewing it with empathy and compassion will lead to much greater calm and connection than seeing it as evidence of the child simply being difficult or manipulative or naughty. That's why we're not at all fans of the conventional approach that calls for parents to completely ignore a tantrum. We agree with the notion that a tantrum is not the time to explain to a child that she's acting inappropriately. A child in the midst of a tantrum is not experiencing what is traditionally called a teachable moment. But the moment can be transformed through connection into an integrative opportunity. Parents tend to over-talk in general when their kids are upset, and asking questions and trying to teach a lesson mid-tantrum can further escalate their emotions. Their nervous systems are already overloaded, and the more we talk, the more we flood their systems with additional sensory input. But that fact doesn't at all logically lead to the conclusion that we should ignore our children when they're distraught. In fact, we're encouraging pretty much the opposite response. Ignoring a child in the midst of a tantrum is one of the worst things we can do, because when a child is that upset, he's actually suffering. He is miserable. The stress hormone cortisol is pumping through his body and washing over his brain, and he feels completely out of control of his emotions and impulses, unable to calm himself or express what he needs. That's suffering. And just like our kids need us to be with them and provide reassurance and comfort when they're physically hurting, they need the same thing when they're suffering emotionally. They need us to be calm and loving and nurturing. They need us to connect. We know how unpleasant a tantrum can be. Believe us, we know. But here's what it really comes down to. What message do you want to send your children? Here are two possibilities. Message one. You're on your own if you get angry and upset. I love you and I'll be here for you once you're done throwing your fit. But as long as you keep acting this way, I'm going to ignore you. So hurry up and finish being upset. Or message number two. I'm here for you even when you're falling apart and at your absolute worst. I can take it. I've got your back, no matter what. When you deliver this second message, you're not giving in. You're not being permissive. It doesn't mean you have to let a child harm himself, destroy things, or put others at risk. You can and should still set boundaries. You may even have to help him control his body or stop an impulse during a tantrum. We'll offer specific suggestions for doing so in the coming chapters. But you set these limits while communicating your love and walking through the difficult moment with your child, always communicating, I'm here. Of course, we want the tantrum to resolve as quickly as possible, just like we want to get out of the dentist chair as soon as we can. It's simply not pleasant. But if you're working from a whole brain perspective, the quickest ending to the tantrum is really not your primary goal. Rather, your first objective, is to be emotionally responsive and present for your child. Your primary goal is to connect, which will offer all the short-term, long-term, and relational benefits we've been discussing. In other words, even though you want the tantrum to end as soon as possible, the larger goal of connecting actually gets you there a lot more efficiently in the short run and achieves a whole lot more in the long run. You'll make things easier and less dramatic for both your child and yourself by providing empathy and your calm presence during a tantrum, and you'll build your child's capacity to handle himself better in the future because emotional responsiveness strengthens the integrative connections in his brain that allow him to make better choices, control his body and emotions, and think about others. How do you connect without spoiling a child? We've said that connection diffuses conflict, builds a child's brain, and strengthens the parent-child relationship. One question parents often raise, though, has to do with a potential drawback of connecting before redirecting. If I'm always connecting when my kids do something wrong, won't I spoil them? In other words, won't that reinforce the behavior that I'm trying to change? These reasonable questions are based on a misunderstanding, so let's take a few moments and discuss what spoiling is and what it's not. Then we can become more clear on why connecting during discipline is quite different from spoiling a child. Let's start with what spoiling is not. Spoiling is not about how much love and time and attention you give your kids. You can't spoil your children by giving them too much of yourself. In the same way, you can't spoil a baby by holding her too much or responding to her needs each time she expresses them. Parenting authorities at one time told parents not to pick up their babies too much for fear of spoiling them. We now know better. Responding to and soothing a child does not spoil her. But not responding to or soothing her creates a child who is insecurely attached and anxious. Nurturing your relationship with your child and giving her the consistent experiences that form the basis of her accurate belief that she's entitled to your love and affection is exactly what we should be doing. In other words, we want to let our kids know that they can count on getting their needs met. Spoiling, on the other hand, occurs when parents or other caregivers create their child's world in such a way that the child feels a sense of entitlement about getting her way, about getting what she wants exactly when she wants it, and that everything should come easily to her and be done for her. We want our kids to expect their needs can be understood and consistently met, but we don't want our kids to expect that their desires and whims will always be met. To paraphrase the Rolling Stones, we want our kids to know that they'll get what they need, even if they can't always get what they want. And connecting when a child is upset or out of control is about meeting that child's needs, not giving in to what she wants. The dictionary definition of spoil is to ruin or do harm to the character or attitude by overindulgence or excessive praise. Spoiling can, of course, occur when we give our kids too much stuff, spend too much money on them, or say yes all the time. But it also occurs when we give children the sense that the world and people around them will serve their whims. Is the current generation of parents more likely to spoil their kids than previous generations? Quite possibly. We see this most commonly when parents shelter their children from having to struggle at all. They overprotect them from disappointments or difficulties. Parents often confuse indulgence on one hand with love and connection on the other. If parents themselves were raised by parents who weren't emotionally responsive and affectionate, they often experience a well-meaning desire to do things differently with their own kids. The problem appears when they indulge their children by giving them more and more stuff and sheltering them from struggles and sadness instead of lavishly offering what their kids really need and what really matters, their love and connection and attention and time, as their children struggle and face the frustrations that life inevitably brings. There's a reason we worry about spoiling our kids by giving them too much stuff. When kids are given whatever they want all the time, they lose opportunities to build resilience and learn important life lessons about delaying gratification, about having to work for something, about dealing with disappointment. Having a sense of entitlement as opposed to an attitude of gratitude can affect relationships in the future when the entitled mindset comes across to others. We also want to give our children the gift of learning to work through difficult experiences. We're doing our child no favor when we find his unfinished homework on the kitchen table and complete it ourselves before running it up to school to protect him from facing the natural consequences of a late assignment, or when we call another parent to ask for an invitation to a birthday party that our child caught wind of but was not invited to. These responses create an expectation in children that they'll experience a pain-free existence, and as a result, they may be unable to handle themselves when life doesn't turn out as they anticipated. Another problematic result of spoiling is that it chooses immediate gratification for both child and parent over what's best for the child. Sometimes we overindulge or decide not to set a limit because it's easier in the moment. Saying yes to that second or third treat of the day might be easier in the short term because it avoids a meltdown. But what about tomorrow? Will treats be expected then as well? Remember, the brain makes associations from all of our experiences. Spoiling ultimately makes life harder on us as parents because we're constantly having to deal with the demands or the meltdowns that result when our kids don't get what they've come to expect, that they'll get their way all the time. Spoiled children often grow up to be unhappy because people in the real world don't respond to their every whim. They have a harder time appreciating the smaller joys and the triumph of creating their own world if others have always done it for them. True confidence and competence come not from succeeding at getting what we want, but from our actual accomplishments and achieving mastery of something on our own. Further, if a child hasn't had practice dealing with the emotions that come with not getting what she wants, and then adapting her attitude and comforting herself, it's going to be quite difficult to do so later when disappointments get bigger. In Chapter 6, by the way, we'll discuss some strategies for dialing back the effects of spoiling if we've gotten into that unhelpful habit. What we're saying is that parents are right to worry about spoiling their kids. Overindulgence is unhelpful for children, unhelpful for parents, and unhelpful for the relationship. But spoiling has nothing to do with connecting with your child when he's upset or making bad choices. Remember, you can't spoil a child by giving him too much emotional connection, attention, physical affection, or love. When our children need us, we need to be there for them. Connection, in other words, isn't about spoiling children, coddling them, or inhibiting their independence. When we call for connection, we're not endorsing what's become known as helicopter parenting, where parents hover over their children's lives, shielding them from all struggles and sadness. Connection isn't about rescuing kids from adversity. Connection is about walking through the hard times with our children and being there for them when they're emotionally suffering, just like we would if they scraped their knee and were physically suffering. In doing so, we're actually building independence, because when our children feel safe and connected, and when we've helped them build relational and emotional skills by disciplining from a whole brain perspective, they'll feel more and more ready to take on whatever life throws their way. you can connect while also setting limits. So yes, as we discipline our children, we want to connect with them emotionally and make sure they know we're there for them when they're having a hard time. But no, this doesn't at all mean we should indulge their every whim. In fact, it would be not only indulgent, but irresponsible if your child were crying and tantruming at the toy store because she didn't want to leave, and you allowed her to keep screaming and throwing anything she could get her hands on. You're not doing a child any favors when you remove boundaries from her life. It doesn't feel good to her, or to you or the other people in the toy store, to allow her emotional explosion to go unfettered. When we talk about connecting with a child who's struggling to control herself, we don't mean you allow her to behave however she chooses. You wouldn't simply say you seem upset to a child as he hurls a Bart Simpson action figure toward a breakable Hello Kitty alarm clock. A more appropriate response would be to say something like, "I can see that you're upset and you're having a hard time stopping your body. I will help you." You might need to gently pick him up or guide him outside as you continue to connect, using empathy and physical touch, remembering that he's needing you until he's calm. Once he's more in control of himself and in a state of mind that's receptive to learning, then you can discuss what happened with him. Notice the difference in the two responses. One, "you seem upset," allows the child's impulses to hold everyone captive, leaving him unaware of what the limits are, and doesn't give him the experience of putting on the brakes when his desires are pressing the gas pedal. The other gives him practice at learning that there are limits on what he can and can't do. Kids need to feel that we care about what they're going through, but they also need us to provide rules and boundaries that allow them to know what's expected in a given environment. When my children were small, I took them to a neighborhood park, where I witnessed a 4 or 5-year-old boy being bossy and too rough with the children around him, some of them quite little. The boy's mother chose not to intervene, ostensibly because she'd rather not solve his problems for him. Eventually, another mom let her know that the boy was being rough and preventing children from using the slide, at which time his mother harshly reprimanded him from across the way, "Brian, let those kids slide or we're going home." In response, he told her that she was stupid and began throwing sand. She said, "Okay, we're going," and began gathering up their things. But he refused to leave. The mom kept making threats, but took no action. When I left with the kids 10 minutes later, the mom and her son were still there. This situation raises a question about what we mean when we talk about connecting. In this case, the issue at hand wasn't that the boy was upset and crying. He was still having a hard time regulating his impulses and handling the situation, but it was expressed more in stubborn and oppositional behavior. Still, connection was in order before his mother attempted to redirect him. When a child isn't overwhelmed by emotions but is simply making less than optimal decisions, connection might mean acknowledging how he's feeling in that moment. She could walk over and say, "It looks like you're having fun deciding who gets to use the slide. Tell me more about what you and your friends are doing here." A simple statement like this, said in a tone that communicates interest and curiosity instead of judgment and anger, establishes an emotional connection between the two of them. The boy's mother can then more credibly follow up with her redirection, which might express the same sentiment she used earlier, but do so in a very different tone. Depending on her own personality and her son's temperament, she could say something like, "I just heard from another mom that some of the kids are wanting to use the slide, and that they're not liking how you're blocking it. The slide is for all the kids at the park. Do you have any ideas for how we can all share it?" In a good moment, he might say something like, "I know, I'll go down and then run around and then they can go down while I'm climbing back up." In a not-so-generous moment, he might refuse, at which time the mother might need to say, "If it's too hard to use the slide in a way that works for you and your friends, then we'll need to do something different, like throwing the frisbee. With these types of statements, the mother would be attuning to his emotional state while still enforcing boundaries that teach that we need to be considerate of others. She could even give him a second chance if need be. But if he then refused to comply and began hurling more insults and more sand, she would have to follow through on the redirection she promised. "I can see you're really angry and disappointed about leaving the park, but we can't stay because you're having a hard time making good choices right now. Would you like to walk to the car, or I can carry you there? It's your choice." Then she'd need to make it happen. So yes, we want to always connect with our children emotionally. But along with connecting, we must help kids make good choices and respect boundaries as we clearly communicate and hold the limits. It's what children need, and even what they want, ultimately. Again, they don't feel good when their emotional states hold them and everyone else hostage. It leaves them on the chaos bank of the river, feeling out of control. We can help move their brains back toward a state of integration and move them back into the flow of the river by teaching them the rules that help them understand how the world and relationships work. Giving parental structure to our children's emotional lives actually gives them a sense of security and the freedom to feel. We want our kids to learn that relationships flourish with respect, nurturing, warmth, consideration, cooperation, and compromise. So we want to interact with them from a perspective that emphasizes both connections and boundary setting. In other words, when we consistently pay attention to their internal world, while also holding to standards about their behavior, these are the lessons they'll learn. From parental sensitivity and structure emerge a child's resourcefulness, resilience, and relational ability. Ultimately, then, kids need us to set boundaries and to communicate our expectations. But the key here is that all discipline should begin by nurturing our children and attuning to their internal world, allowing them to know that they are seen, heard, and loved by their parents, even when they've done something wrong. When children feel seen, safe, and soothed, they feel secure, and they thrive. This is how we can value our children's minds while helping to shape and structure their behavior. We can help guide a behavioral change, teach a new skill, and impart an important way of approaching a problem, all while valuing a child's mind beneath the behavior. This is how we discipline, how we teach, while nurturing a child's sense of self and sense of connection to us. Then they'll interact with the world around them based on these beliefs and with these social and emotional skills because their brains will be wired to expect that their needs will be met and that they are unconditionally loved. So the next time one of your children loses control or does something that drives you completely crazy, remind yourself that a child's need to connect is greatest in times of high emotion. Yes, you'll need to address the behavior to redirect and teach the lessons. But first, reframe those big feelings and recognize them for what they are, a bid for connection. When your child is at his worst, that's when he needs you the most. To connect is to share in your child's experience, to be present with him, to walk through this difficult time with him. In doing so, you help integrate his brain and offer him the emotional regulation he's unable to access on his own. Then he can move back into the flow of the river of well-being. You will have helped him move from reactivity to receptivity, helped build his brain, and deepened and strengthened the relationship you two share.
Chapter 4, No Drama Connection in Action. My family and I were eating dinner at home one night when my husband and I noticed that our 6-year-old hadn't returned from the bathroom for several minutes. We found him playing on my iPad in the living room. At first, I was frustrated because my 6-year-old had broken several of our rules. He had snuck away from the table, and he had played on the iPad without asking. He had also taken the iPad out of its protective case, which he knew he wasn't supposed to do. None of the infractions was significant. The problem was that he was disregarding the rules we had all agreed to. First, I thought about my son and his temperament and developmental stage. As Dan and I have said several times now, context always has to be taken into consideration when deciding how to discipline. I knew that because my son is a sensitive and conscientious little guy, I probably wouldn't need to say much to discipline him. My husband, Scott, and I sat on the couch next to him, and I simply said in a curious tone, "What happened here?" Immediately, my son's lower lip began to quiver, and tears pooled in his eyes. "I just wanted to try Minecraft." The nonverbal communication was a reflection of his inner conscience and his own discomfort, and the words were an admission of guilt. Implicit in his statement was the message, "I know I wasn't supposed to leave the table and get the iPad, but I just wanted to play so bad my impulse was too strong." By this moment, in other words, I already knew that the redirection part of our conversation wasn't going to be too challenging. At other times it is, but not now, when there was already an awareness on his part. Before redirecting, though, I wanted to meet him where he was and to connect with him emotionally. I said, "You really are interested in that game, aren't you? You're curious about what the bigger boys are playing." Scott followed my lead and said something about how cool it is that the game allows you to create a whole world full of buildings and tunnels and animals. Our son sheepishly looked up at us, moving his eyes from me to Scott, questioning whether things were really okay among us all. Then he nodded and gave us a soft smile. With these few sentences and glances, connection had been established. Scott and I could then redirect. And again, knowing our son and recognizing where he was at this moment, the situation didn't require much from us. Scott simply asked, "But what about our rules?" Here our son began to cry in earnest. Not much more needed to be said because the lesson had already been internalized. I put my arm around him to comfort him. I said, "I know your choices tonight didn't follow our rules. Is there anything you'd do differently next time?" He nodded as he cried, then promised to ask to be excused before leaving the table next time. We hugged, and then Scott asked him a Minecraft question, which led him to explain to his dad something about a trapdoor in a dungeon. As he became more animated, he moved past his guilt and his tears, and we all rejoined the rest of the family at the table. Connection had led to redirection, meaning not only that teaching could occur, but also that our son felt understood and loved. Setting the stage for connection. Response, flexibility. In the previous chapter, we discussed connection as the first step of the discipline process. Now we'll focus on what that actually looks like in action, recommending principles and strategies you can rely on when your child is upset or misbehaving. Sometimes connection is fairly simple, as it was here for me. Often it's much more challenging. As we discuss recommendations for connection, avoid the temptation to look for the formulaic one-size-fits-all technique that is supposed to apply in every situation. The following principles and strategies are extremely effective most of the time, but you should apply these approaches based on your own parenting style, the situation at hand, and your individual child's temperament. In other words, maintain response flexibility. Response flexibility means just what it sounds like, being flexible about our response to a situation. It means pausing to think and to choose the best course of action. It lets us separate stimulus from response, so that our reaction doesn't immediately and unintentionally follow from a child's behavior or our own internal chaos. So when A happens, we don't just automatically do B. Instead, we consider B, C, or even a combo of D and E. Response flexibility creates a space in time and in our minds that enables a wide range of possibilities to be considered. As a result, we can just be with an experience, if only for a few seconds, and reflect before engaging the do circuitry of action. Response flexibility helps you choose to be your wisest self possible in a difficult moment with your child, so that connection can occur. It's pretty much the opposite of autopilot discipline, where you apply a robotic one-size-fits-all approach to every scenario that arises. When we're flexible in our responses to our children's state of mind and their misbehavior, we allow ourselves to intentionally respond to a situation in the best way possible and provide our kids with what they need in the moment. Depending on your child's infraction, this might require taking a moment to calm down. It's a good rule of thumb not to respond the nanosecond after you witness a misbehavior. We know you may feel, in the heat of the moment, like laying down the law, yelling that since your daughter pushed her brother into the pool, she's done swimming for the rest of the summer. Aren't we ridiculous sometimes? But if you can take a few seconds and allow yourself to calm down, rather than making a scene at the public pool and overshooting the discipline mark, you'll have a better chance at intentionally responding out of a calmer and more thoughtful part of yourself to what your child actually needs right then. As a bonus, you can avoid being the subject of dinner conversations all around town that begin, "You should have seen this crazy lady at the pool today." At other times, response flexibility may lead you to decide to take a firmer stand on an issue than you normally might. If you notice signs that your 11-year-old is taking less initiative with his responsibilities and his schoolwork, you might decide not to drive him back to school so he can retrieve the book he, again, has no idea how, he left in his locker. You would sincerely empathize with him and make sure to connect. "Ugh, it's such a bummer that you forgot your book and won't have your assignment ready tomorrow." But you'd allow him to experience the natural and logical fallout of his forgetfulness. Or maybe you would take him to get his book because his personality or the context of the situation leads you to believe that approach would be best. That's the whole point. Response flexibility means you're making a point to decide how you want to respond to each situation that arises, rather than just simply reacting without thinking about it. Like so many aspects of parenting, response flexibility is fundamentally about parenting intentionally. We're talking about remaining mindful of meeting the needs of your child, this particular child, in this particular moment. When that goal is central in your mind, connection will necessarily follow. Now let's look at some specific ways you can use response flexibility to connect with your kids when they're having a hard time handling themselves well or when they're making unwise decisions. We'll start by focusing on three no-drama connection principles that set the stage and allow for connection between parent and child. Then we'll move to some more immediate, in-the-moment connection strategies. Connection principle number one, turn down the shark music. If you've heard Dan speak, you may have seen him introduce the concept of shark music. Here's how he explains the idea.
First, I ask the audience to monitor the response of their bodies and minds as I show them a 30-second video. This video was originally produced by the Circle of Security Intervention Program. You can see their great work in the book, The Circle of Security Intervention, by Burke Powell and colleagues, New York, Guilford Press, 2013. On the screen, the audience sees what appears to be a beautiful forest. From the point of view of the person holding the camera, the audience sees a rustic trail and moves down that path toward a beautiful ocean. All the while, calm, classical-sounding piano music plays, communicating a sense of peace and serenity in an idyllic environment. I then stop the video and ask the audience to watch it again, explaining that I'm going to show them the exact same video, But this time, different music will play in the background. The audience then sees the same images, the forest, the rustic trail, the ocean, but the soundtrack this time is dark and menacing. It's like the famous theme music from the movie Jaws, and it completely colors the way the scene is perceived. The peaceful scene now looks threatening. Who knows what might jump out? And the path leads somewhere we're pretty sure we don't want to go. There's no telling what we'll find in the water at the end of the trail. Based on the music, it's likely a shark. But despite our fear, the camera continues to approach the water. The exact same images, but as the audience discovers, the experience drastically changes with different background music. One soundtrack leads to peace and serenity, the other to fear and dread.
It's the same when we interact with our children. We have to pay attention to our background music. Shark music takes us out of the present moment, causing us to practice fear-based parenting. Our attention is on whatever we are feeling reactive about. We worry about what's coming in the future, or we respond to something from the past. When we do so, we miss what's actually happening in the moment, what our children really need, and what they're actually communicating. As a result, we don't give them our best. Shark music, in other words, keeps us from parenting this individual child in this individual moment. For instance, imagine that your fifth grader comes home with her first progress report, which shows that since she was sick and missed a couple of days of class, her math average is lower than you'd expect. Without shark music playing in the background, you might just chalk this up to the absences or to the more difficult subject matter in fifth grade. You'd take steps to make sure she understands the material now, and you might or might not decide to visit with her teacher. In other words, you'd approach the situation from a calm and rational perspective. If, however, your daughter's older brother is a ninth grader who has shown himself to be less than responsible with his homework and who is struggling with the basics of algebra, this prior experience might become shark music that plays in your mind as your daughter shows you her progress report. "Here we go again," might be the refrain that takes over your thoughts. So instead of responding to the situation as you normally would, asking your daughter how she feels about it and trying to figure out what's best for her, you think about your son's problems with algebra and you overreact to your daughter's situation. You begin talking to her about consequences and cutting back on after-school activities. If the shark music really gets to you, maybe you start lecturing about getting into good colleges and the chain of events that leads from a couple of bad grades in fifth grade math to problems in middle school and high school, and finally to a slew of rejection letters from universities all across the country. Before you know it, your adorable 10-year-old has become a homeless woman pushing a shopping cart toward the cardboard box she lives in under the bridge down by the river. All because she got mixed up about which way the greater than symbol points. The key to a no-drama response, as is so often the case, is awareness. Once you recognize that shark music is blaring in your mind, you can shift your state of mind and stop parenting based on fear and on past experiences that don't apply to the current scenario you face. Instead, you can connect with your child who might be feeling discouraged. You can give her what she needs in this moment, a parent who is fully present, parenting only her, based only on the actual facts of this particular situation, not on past expectations or future fears. This isn't to say that we don't pay attention to patterns of behavior over time. We can also get trapped in states of denial where we over-contextualize behavior or explain away our kids' repeated struggles with all kinds of excuses that keep us from seeking intervention or from helping our children build the skills they need. You've met the parent who has a child who is never at fault and whom the parents never hold accountable. For instance, "Every member of the marching band turned the wrong direction except for my daughter. Can you believe that?" Or, Sorry, but my son is on new allergy medication, plus he's transitioning to the new dog. Or, my daughter failed her test because she just got a new mattress and the off-gassing toxins interfered with her sleep. When the excuse flavor of the week becomes a pattern of parental response, then the parents are probably working from a different kind of shark music. It's similar to the parents whose children were medically vulnerable as babies, whose shark music now leads them to overdo for their kids, treating them as if they are still more fragile than they actually are. The point is that shark music can prevent us from parenting intentionally and from being who our children need us to be at any given moment. It makes us reactive instead of receptive. Sometimes we're called to adjust our expectations and realize that our children just need more time for development to unfold. At other times, we need to adjust our expectations and realize that our children are capable of more than we're asking of them, so we can challenge them to take more responsibility for their choices. At still other times, we need to pay attention to our own needs, desires, and past experiences, any of which can override our ability to make good moment-by-moment decisions. The problem is that when we are reactive, we can't receive input from others or demonstrate any response flexibility to consider the various options in our own mind. If you'd like to go deeper with this concept, Dan covers it extensively in his book, Parenting from the Inside Out, co-authored with Mary Hartzell. Ultimately, our job is to give unconditional love and calm presence to our kids, even when they're at their worst. Especially when they're at their worst. That's how we stay receptive instead of going reactive. And the perspective we take on their behavior will necessarily affect how we respond to them. If we recognize them for the still developing young people they are, with changing, changeable, complex young brains, then when they struggle or do something we don't like, we'll be better able to be receptive and hear the calming piano music. We'll therefore interact with them in a way that's more likely to lead to peace and serenity. Shark music, on the other hand, will take us out of the present moment and out of our right minds as we become reactive. It will fuel our internal chaos and lead us to make all kinds of assumptions, to worry about all kinds of possibilities that simply shouldn't be considered in this particular situation. It might even lead us to automatically assume that our kids are acting out because they are selfish, lazy, spoiled, or whatever other label we choose. Then we'll respond not out of love and intentionality, but out of reactivity, anger, anxiety, drama, and fear. So the next time you need to discipline, pause for just a second and listen for the soundtrack in your head. If you hear calm piano music and feel capable of offering a loving, objective, clear-headed response to the situation, then go ahead and offer just that kind of response. But if you notice the shark music, be very careful about what you do and say. Give yourself a minute, longer if necessary, before responding. Then when you feel yourself letting go of the fears, expectations, and bigger-than-necessary reactivity that keep you from looking at the situation for what it really is, you can respond. Simply by paying attention to whatever music is playing in the background of a disciplinary moment, you'll be much more capable of responding flexibly instead of reacting rigidly or chaotically, and offering your children what they need right then. Responding rather than reacting is the key. Connection principle number 2, chase the why. One of the worst byproducts of shark music is the parental tendency to make assumptions about what we perceive to be obvious. If a scary or emotionally charged soundtrack is clouding your mind when you interact with your children, you're not likely to be very objective about the reasons they're behaving the way they are. Instead, you're probably going to simply react based on information that might not be accurate at all. You'll assume there's a shark swimming in the water or a monster hiding behind the tree, even if there's not one. When your kids are playing in the next room and you hear your younger child begin to cry, it may seem perfectly justifiable to march into the room